Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Radio. This is your host, Evan Poss, and I'm here with Daniel Michael, founder of Main Street Universe Network. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Evan, and how are you today?
I'm doing quite well. I'm glad to be here. Cafe Fairfax, right?
Yes, Cafe Fairfax is his name. He's here live in studio with us. And tell us a little bit something about Zariana.
Well, Zariana is a concept I've been developing the last several years. I suppose ultimately what it comes down to is an appreciation for the story in the broadest sense. I became very interested in the ideas of mythology and myth-making. Studying the classics, of course. And I wanted to know why people in today's world couldn't write their own mythology, have their own mythos that they subscribe to, tell their own stories, create their own gods and goddesses. And it seems to me that, especially in today's world, so many of the metaphors are turning over. A metaphor of the plow or of a bow and arrow doesn't really register in the modern psyche in the same way that it might have 1,000 years ago or several thousand years ago or even 100 years ago. Now we have automobiles and sky-rise buildings. We're entering a space age. Quantum mechanics, theories of evolution, the list goes on and on. Electronic music. So it seems like the metaphors that we have available to us not only are perhaps more plentiful, but really there is of a different nature. There's no denying this is a different world that we live in. When exactly it turned over and how long it's taking to turn over and what we're turning over into, it's entirely open to speculation. But I think it's quite apparent that we are dealing with a new set of metaphors now. And I suppose that's really what inspired me to, create for myself a new mythos. And it's not a universal mythos by any means. It's what I would call a personal mythos. It's something I've created for myself, for my own well-being. A story, or a set of stories, that grounds me in the world I live in. And I suppose for many of us in the world today, we need that grounding. For so many of us, there's a sense of isolation, alienation from the people around us, from the world that we live in. We're all trying to come to terms with it and, live our good lives in the world. And it's not always easy. And so, This is, for me, it started off as a completely personal exercise, almost as an experiment, really. Going into this, I had no idea whether or not it was possible and what I was going to getting myself into. It was just sort of my own natural expression Can a person do this? Can I myself do this? Can I create a mythos for myself? It'll ground me in a world that I, you know, feel honestly a great deal of distance from. And in the process, I feel it has. It's succeeded in so many ways, and it's many unexpected results. I feel like I've given life to something. And it's by no means something that I want other people to subscribe to. But what I think it points to is the fact that every person can do this. Every person can create their own mythos. And this goes back to what Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell, particular, two of my favorite thinkers,
mm-hmm.
have spent their lives drawing out these conclusions. And all of us have been fortunate enough to be born into a world where this stuff is at our fingertips. You know, all their writings and the writings of great sages and mystics and saints from thousands of years past are all available, you know, to anyone now. They're being published, they're on the internet. The internet, that's another great example of a new mythos or new metaphor that we have for creating mythos. You know, something that we relate to all the time. It's, you know, what some people choose to call the emerging technological singularity or informational singularity.
Mm-hmm.
All information coming together to a single source. We can't even point to it. Where is the internet exactly? It's not in the wires. It's not in the computers. You know, it's in interspace or some such thing. You know, and when we think of like how we use our language to describe this, it inevitably takes on a somewhat mystical quality. And you know, I suppose that's a little bit of a rambling towards what has encouraged me and propelled me into this. And here I am. You know, you've invited me onto the Main Street Universe Network, and all of a sudden I have a medium to share this with the world and with so many listeners, and it's really a blessing.
And since you're new here for this episode, I'll just ask you a few opening questions as some of your background, which you've already given some, so I don't have to go too far. I just wanted to say, I want one or two points that I liked about when we talked about it in private was, A, our active role in myth, not just it being something from the past, and the other one being, which you touched on just now, and I liked when you said, I believe it was your quote, as religion as art, and I thought that was a great quote, and enjoyed that idea, and again, it has that feeling of activity. It's not something that's way far away, ancient. Oh, if I forgot this little rule during this phase of the moon, everything's going to be, you know, destroyed. You have an active role. I mean, those things can still be important, and those rules are very important to some people for very various reasons. But I like your approach being that we have an active role in myth and in our own myths, and we can create them, and they can be very real.
Absolutely.
So, I guess my question is, and that what some people would ask listening here for the first time, they would ask, well, okay, so he's talking about myth creation and even pantheon creation, God or goddess creation. They might ask, what is your training? What is your pantheon before pantheon creation?
All right, so yeah, I suppose a little bit of background is in order here.
Yeah.
Last year, spring of 2011, you know, I have no lofty credentials here, but I graduated from Humboldt State University with a degree in religious studies. My focus was on the Eastern traditions, Hinduism in particular. I spent 4 months in India doing a semester abroad. It was one of the most influential four-month periods of my life. Absolutely fell in love with India. Somewhat, to a certain extent, knew I was in love with it before I ever went there, but just confirmed it so many times over. you know, and going a little bit further into the past, you know, people ask, like, what's your religion? What were you raised? I get that all the time, especially for someone who, you know, so often has to tell people, you know, like, what I studied. I'm a religious studies major. Oh, so what are you going to do with that? Or what's your religion? You know, I think it's something that religious studies majors are both blessed and plagued with, are these questions, and we really don't know how to answer them, you know, to anyone's satisfaction. There is no simple answer to it. I'll tell you that in a very liberal sense, I was raised Jewish. My mom's Jewish. My dad, you could say, is a disenchanted Catholic. And so, you know, that can take the other extreme. You know, Catholicism, it's really such a beautiful tradition. And the more I learn about it, the more I fall in love with it myself. But the truth is, it's pushed a lot of people away from religion in a very strong way. You know, it's unfortunate. It has nothing to do with the religion itself, with the essence of it. But, you know, it's just something how religion manifests itself in our world, in a human world, where ideals are not lived up to, and in fact, they're somewhat trampled upon by the very people who, you know, claim to be their proprietors. So, you know, I was raised Jewish in a very, very loose sense. You know, my family didn't keep kosher or anything. It was, you know, we celebrated Passover. I didn't really go to temple. My family's not very religious. But it's just something that I've been drawn to over the years. Ever since I was a little kid, there's a compulsion, you know. And I notice that not everyone has this sort of compulsion, but many people do. And for those who do, it's very important that we discuss these things. And, you know, there's so much to learn. In a lot of ways, we're, you know, our entire species right now, we're like infants coming into some novel new idea for the first time. Maybe not for the first time, but it might as well be the first time for us because we've lost so much for our connection.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost a lot, and at the same time, because this is a new world and because we have new metaphors, there is something completely new and novel about it that truly has never existed before. So we're coming up on a return cycle. At the same time, the cycle itself is completely new. And, you know, something about that just fascinated me and sent me into religious studies, and, you know, here I am.
And I wanted to touch upon, when you talked about losing something, not only as a species, just in one lifetime, you can very quickly lose touch with divine things. And I'll give just nature as an example. If you grow up, now I'm a person, I will freely admit, I love living in a city. I like being around a lot of people, and I'm a people person. But if you grow up in the country and then you move away from it and then you don't live that life anymore, it's like you used to have a better ability to hear things and see things, you know, out in the woods, and if you know what I'm getting at. And then you can lose that and those natural instincts very quickly, just in one lifetime, not to mention how quickly we can lose our connection with nature over many, or just as a species as a whole in the technological age. I just wanted to touch upon that when you mentioned something.
Absolutely. And, you know, I could relate to that on a somewhat personal level, having just moved out to Northern Virginia from Northern California. You know, it's a very different world out here, coming from spending 6 years in the redwood forest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my ideal climate and living situation, very small town, rustic environment, a very nourishing environment at that, to moving out into the city, or not the city as much as suburbs. You know, you can call it the sprawl, or I like to.
Sure, it's kind of an in-between here. We're certainly not in the country here. We're kind of a cross between a city and a suburb,
yeah.
I think.
But it has its own benefits, and I'm really glad to be out here. And a lot of my motivation for coming out here is just because I want to develop certain part of myself, part of my mind, and part of my personality that wasn't getting worked out in wasn't getting any exercise, you know, in the small town environment where you see several people you know every time you go to the market and every time you walk down the street, you know. I feel like it's, to a certain extent, it could be good for people to switch it up back and forth one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stay in your comfort zone. Move around. See new places. Live new places. Meet new people. New experiences. It's always good for you, you know. It breaks up your identity in a certain extent and allows you to continuously
evolve,
exactly. And also, I want to touch on something real quick. You know, we're talking so much now about, or I suppose it might seem like there's a juxtaposition between nature and the earlier, you know, cycles that humanity has evolved out of, and the technological age that we find ourselves in today. And, you know, I think it's so important that we talk about these things without judgment, without trying to label one way or the other that, you know, one is good, one is bad, or, you know, even better or worse. They're both their own entities. And, you know, really when it gets down to it, there's trying to find the line between them, you know, you're going to be hard-pressed to do that because the line sort of, like everything, dissolves under analysis. You know, it's, little phrase I've taken out of Buddhism that I find is beautiful and applies to so many situations. You know, the drawing line does dissolve under analysis. Whether we are living in the cycles of nature or whether we're living in a technological world that we've created for ourselves, well, the fact is, you know, human beings have, you know, this is the way I see it, we've evolved out of the cycles of nature ourselves, and there's no reason to assume that we have separated ourselves or somehow removed ourselves from those cycles. You know, I'm looking around at our studio right now, and there's wires and mixing boards and all sorts of instruments and
guitars on the wall and
guitars,
drum set.
Speakers. Right. You know, who's to say that this isn't an expression of nature?
Sure.
Where's the drawing line? And I think, you know, that kind of brings us back to what I was first thinking of with, you know, how I understand my mythos with Zara. You know, she's a goddess who has evolved out of the cycles of nature. And she's a goddess who has evolved out of the processes of my own mind, you could say. Or, you know, perhaps I've evolved out of the processes of her mind.
Yeah.
But, I've always understood her from the very beginning to be a goddess of technology. And there's no clear way to put that other than she's a goddess who takes upon herself technological metaphors. I think the most obvious of these has to do with space travel, time travel, quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
It's simply the language that I use to describe her. And, you know, I think it's useful because what it does is it grounds us in the world that we live in today. I think it's somewhat silly to just, you know, so often we have science on one side of the battlefield and religion on the other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, folks, it doesn't have to be like that. It simply isn't.
And that was one of the actually things that inspired the entire creation of our show and network, the Mystic Universe Network. We talk about it a lot. It's how myth inspires science, how science inspires myth, and it's a back and forth. And they do not necessarily, when I say myth, I mean I believe in these things and quantum mechanics and metaphysical practice and all that magic. And I don't think they're necessarily separate, as you were saying. And we talk about that a lot. In fact, we talked about string theory and time travel and how the myths of the old days involve a similar technology that they're talking about now with quantum mechanics and quantum physics as far as the potential for traveling through time and how you might need a protective bubble and then kind of step in and then come back. But in the old myths, it was usually like a little magic box you're not supposed to open or you'll age, or it was a magical horse you jump on that you're not supposed to dismount.
Or it's going into the fairyland and coming back, you know, maybe in the past or well into the future.
Yeah, and oftentimes if it's in the future, you're not supposed to, you know, open this little thing or take this ring off or dismount this horse, or you'll age like everybody else and catch up and die. And now quantum physicists are talking about, oh, well, you need to be protected in some sort of bubble that you can't step out of if you're going to travel through time this way. So anyway, long story short, I don't want to talk about yesterday's show too much, today's show, but your point, basically, of how myth and science do not necessarily, or magic and science do not necessarily have to be separate things.
Exactly. You know, this looking at the feedback loop between the two, it's fascinating. We can talk about it endlessly. And, you know, all these sort of things that we've just been flushing out right now, all these, you know, interesting ideas, we're going to get to in, you know, much more further detail and give them much more justice as we progress through the show, you know. And I'd like to say, I don't think it's been mentioned, but this is my first episode. This is our debut.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm very excited to be here, and this is really thankful for the opportunity, Dan.
Oh, it's great. And I love the name Zariana. I think it's a great name. And I'd like to, I guess, one more question, and we'll maybe get on to what you had planned.
Right.
And, and that is also, you're also a tarot reader as well. So talking about practice as far as your physical nuts and bolts, I guess, metaphysical practice. Part of it is a divination, and you are a tarot reader, and I believe it's, you read from the Thoth deck, if I'm correct.
That's correct, and I'm also you use the Rider-Waite deck as well.
Okay.
But I started off with a Thoth Tarot. The Rider-Waite came much later. And in a lot of ways, I was thankful for it because it simplifies so much the imagery.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I started off with a Thoth Tarot because it, you know, gave me that opportunity to really dive into the symbolism heavily and, you know, get some of the deeper structures of the tarot cemented in my mind. Now, every time I draw a Rider-Waite card, the image that comes to my mind is a Thoth card.
Mm-hmm. You just.
But on that note, I feel like, you know, I don't know what the situation is for all people, but, you know, a lot of people have a tradition that they, you know, through which they learn these things, or perhaps it's passed down through the family. For me, I just knew I had an interest in it, and I had no resources available to me to study these things except books.
Imagine it, you know, like when me, I was a teenager in the 80s, you know, I'm older than you, and back then it was, I mean, you didn't know if you had good information, bad information, if you met somebody that was a reader, or, you know, in my case, I was fascinated by anybody that was any kind of magical practitioner. I met an old lady who claimed to be a witch, and she taught me about spiritual law and spiritualism. And I mean, who know? You don't know if anybody, what they're telling you. You didn't go online and look it up. It was just, you know, there was no online back then. So it is funny how, like you say, for some people they learn physically, some people it's passed down, and for some you're piecing it together.
Piecing it together, exactly. You know, that old witch surely had her own tradition, and it doesn't really matter whether it was grounded in an earlier tradition or not, because she's forged for herself her own tradition, you know. And for me, that's what I've realized, that's what I've come to, and I think that's what's most important. So as far as tarot and astrology before that, without knowing a single thing, not one sign from another, never knowing a single tarot card, I, you know, just got as many books as I could. And started devouring them. I remember the first giant book on astrology that my roommate at the time, Kelly, brought home. She was working at a place called the University of Metaphysical Sciences.
Mm.
She brings home this giant, dense book of astrology, and in a week of not sleeping while I'm still trying to go to school, staying up all night, read every single page of it, just worked out every chart in every which way, and, you know, just downloaded it into my mind as kind of as a whole. And that's where I got my start. It's a beautiful age we live in, that we have such access to books and information. Mm-hmm. Anyone who wants to learn this stuff, you can be your own teacher. And the great teachers of the past and present were in such a position that they're putting their teachings out there. Of course, it's always the best thing to sit at the feet of a sage and, you know, hear the wisdom from mouth to ear. That's truly the most exquisite way of obtaining this information, and perhaps the best too. I completely agree, and there's really no substitution for that. But for where we're at, and for the most of us who have limited resources and, you know, can only
now there's the internet too, of course.
There's the internet too. That's true. But all this information is at our fingertips, and, you know, perhaps that will encourage us more than ever to seek out these people who, you know, have received the oral tradition or the mind transfer that's come down through the ages. And I like to believe that there's more sages, mystics, and saints on the planet right now than there's ever been before, which is actually true because just by statistics and number of people on this planet. One of my favorite writers says something to the effect of, in the past there might have only been a handful of Buddhas on the entire planet. Now there's at least 10 Buddhas in every city you go to. It's something to keep in mind, you know. There's, and it's a sense of hope too. There's traditions or lore to the effect that the world will never be destroyed as long as there's still one true master out there, one great saint. And there's hundreds and thousands. It's a good age we live in. It's a beautiful age. Very interesting times.
I agree. Some people say, the good old days. I'm like, well, I think I'd rather be alive right now. Would you really want to be alive during what I see as the awkwardness of the 50s. Like, look at the way the United States was about things like race and everything else, women's rights. Maybe the 60s, if you felt like getting drafted and going to Vietnam. I was a kid in the 70s. I'm 41. I feel like I was born into a great age. I don't look back to some old age and think, oh, gosh, I should have been there. I think this is the time, and this is the age, and it's right for whatever my lessons are for this incarnation. It seems right to me, and now it's up to me. That's how I view it.
Absolutely. Say for women, for example, if you wanted to be ordained as a Buddhist nun, you're out of luck. Every religious tradition has historically been incredibly misogynistic, and that's one of the beautiful things about this age is that religion is opening up in so many ways, and I think women are really taking the leading role right now in almost every religious tradition, especially in the United States. In Hinduism, in Buddhism, in yoga, women are leading the way for men. We're just starting to figure these things out. For so long it was thought it was something women couldn't do, weren't allowed to do. And, that's also part of the beauty of being in America and, this new phenomenon of American yoga and so many different things like that.
And you were just talking to a female reverend just a few minutes before you walked in here, actually.
Yes, I was.
My sister-in-law, Reverend Anya Samuel Michael, for a few minutes there. So, yes, and when you said they were misogynistic, some of the traditions, but they certainly were not without their value and without their wisdom, but it's part of our point, and it often comes up on Main Street Universe in general, is things being alive and evolving and our active role in them.
Right. So think right now what I would like to do, I think that was a good introduction. Let's jump a little bit more into the show. I think the first thing I would like to do, before we go any further, this being the first show, the beginning of the first show, I'd like to do an invocation to a certain deity very close to my heart and very well grounded in tradition, but also a deity, I think, that has done remarkably well in this new world and as things are transforming. And that's Ganesha. For those of you who don't know, Ganesha is the elephant-headed deity in the Hindu pantheon. And he's known as the Lord of Beginnings. At the beginning of every new endeavor, it's said to invoke Ganesha. And he will remove all the obstacles. That's another one of his titles, is the remover of obstacles. Ganesha is a deity of, you could say, the betwixt and the between, and the liminal. Ganesha isn't here or there. He's always in between this world and that world, this dimension and that dimension, you can say, past and future. And in that sense, he's always with us. You know, human beings ourselves are liminal creatures, and perhaps that's why so many people can relate to him as well as we can. And as far as gods go, you know, some, you get the idea that they're wrathful, they're vengeful, or at least intimidating. I think that's fair to say about a lot of religion. It can definitely be intimidating at times. And Ganesha is an incredibly approachable god. There's a humorous side to him. And there's just something lovable about him. And my really good friend, Jason Melrose, who I was roommates with for a while, and actually I was roommates with while we were in India. He studied with me there, and we traveled. He is a Ganesha Bhakta, and knows more about Ganesha than anyone else I know. He's done extensive research into it. And while I was in India, you know, he was studying why it is that Ganesha is so beloved. And, you know, it's just quite clear that we see, you know, when I was traveling with them and people ask, like, what we're doing, and Jason tells them that, you know, I'm studying Ganesha. Without fail, every person's face just lights up. There's a smile and a light that shines through. They say that, you know, although certain deities in the Hindu pantheon are more worshipped than others as, you know, supreme deities, you know, the three most common being Vishnu, Shiva, and Mahadevi, the great goddess, there are more images of Ganesha than there are of any other god in India. They are literally everywhere. Little elephant-headed statues. Everywhere you look. In temples, in stores, in restaurants, in fields, you know. Shrines everywhere to Ganesha. He's just the absolute beloved. And I feel like I have a great deal to owe to him. Just because I've really taken it to heart, you know, to invoke Ganesha at the beginning of every new endeavor. And so many of my endeavors have been blessed with such amazing success, you know, that I want to pay that forward. And there's another idea that the power that a god or goddess has is dependent upon the power with which people believe in that god or goddess. You know, the deity relies on the human beings to propagate them. You know, in a very real sense that they live within us, just like all our thoughts live within us and our ideas. And when we give voice to that, when we create a space in our mind for the god to exist, that's the only opportunity they have for interacting with us and for giving us their blessings. You know, so it's really not just enough to know that there's a God out there and not to give it any thought. Perhaps it is. But in my personal experience and practice, I think it's very important to create that space for the God to come alive within you. So now we have a moment. We're going to do a very quick mantra, and then we'll get on to the rest of our show. Om Gam Ganapataye Namaha. And believe me, folks, my Sanskrit pronunciation is far from perfect, but I promise you I'm working on it.
I wanted to say quickly, it is me, Daniel, operating the board today. Kevin Baird is not here. And we are live in Cafe Fairfax, and something is happening to our chat room again. I don't know what it is. I apologize if there's little ins and outs with the chat room. I was just talking on it, mentioning that I'm going to go get a glass of water, and something happened, and the chat room disappeared. And I clicked on it again, so it looks like it's loading up again, so we'll see what happens. They've been doing updates. The caller identifications on the left are at least accurate today. They were, even Mark Mandrake was mentioning the other night on Sunday that his was acting up too and that he couldn't even do a show. Everything seems to be better now, but the chat's still acting up a little as they do their updates. But it looks like it's coming back. It's just loading right now. So for those of you in the chat room, if you just wait a few seconds, it looks like we're going to be back there in a few seconds.
To all our listeners and chatters out there, thanks for being patient with us. You know, we're trying to make it happen out here, and I got to hand it to Dan. It's he's definitely taken this onto himself and started his own radio network, and it's no easy task figuring out all this technology. You know, I know for myself, I have no savviness in the ways of computers and whatnot, and he's definitely figuring it out quite well. So thanks for being patient.
Oh, I'm not very savvy either. It's not that hard, it's just that I'm not that savvy. But this actually is a technical glitch. This is not my fault.
Well, Zara be with us, the technological goddess.
That's right. With the mantra of bringing her in.
All right, so Dan will be right back with you guys. And while he's out, I'd like to talk a little bit about the theme in the story. The theme of this show, in a general sense, what I want to do with it, what I'm trying to accomplish here. The idea is storytelling and mythology, and bringing it into our own lives and giving life to it in a world where perhaps we've lost some connection with it. Each of us is a storyteller. Each of us lives our mythology. And it's not something that we're distanced from. Gods and goddesses, as I said, are alive within us to the extent that we allow them to be. And each of us has the potential to take that into our own hands and reclaim religion. And as Dan mentioned before, the idea that religion is art, and art is religion, that we can create this for ourselves. And if we're not satisfied with the current state of religion, that's something that we can take into our own hands and reinvent in however we see best. So the idea that I had is for people calling into the show, if someone has written a piece of personal mythology or a short story or poetry, anything like this, or not even necessarily something that you've written, something that you found from some other text or book, or something that perhaps a friend has written that you found particularly meaningful and you would like to share. I want this show to be an avenue for expressing all these things and for sharing poetry and for sharing the art of storytelling, for bringing it back alive. We're going to wait just a minute for Daniel Michael to get back into the studio. And then I'd like to read a piece that I myself wrote maybe a month or two ago, very recent. And this it does involve my myth, the Zara mythos. And I myself would, I think what we're going to do is read maybe one story or a piece of poetry or something, you know, maybe one or two every episode, just to, you know, as part of the theme, really. But without holding you up any further, I'd like to read this. It's not terribly long, and doesn't really have a title. I'm just going to go. I hope you like it. Listen. Listen. It is told that their names are identical up to the last syllable and a half, because they're identical down to the last segment and a half of programming sequence, by which Kumbha Kwari is known as the waters below, and Kumbha Kwanta known as the waters above. Flowing from the one spring and overflowing from the one well is only by way of perception that they are distinguished. For truly it is spoken that they partake of a singular essence. The estuary at their convergence has been called life by those incapable of accepting a thing for which there is no word, ineffable though it must ultimately be, this confounded storyteller being no exception. And surely I am worse than most, for what is the essence of my craft but the raising of linguistic pyramids out of finely hewn blocks of the ineffable? Life, as we reason, contains Kumbha Kwari and Kumbha Kwanta both, in more or less equal measure. They are as pots, or rather, pots within pots. Attempt not to separate the vessel from its contents, but do wonder upon its transparent mystery, for the truth remains balanced in sublime equipoise for all to behold. For all those possessed of that rare grace which spurs us to uproot the karmic compulsion to strangle that which we do not understand and therefore cannot tolerate, ideas though they may be. Gaze and be fulfilled. That which fills the pots, the thaumaturges of ages not yet come, have pronounced Kumbha Kwari and Kumbha Kwanta. That draught which we drink from them so deeply, with every breath, with every heartbeat, that is called ki, light, consciousness, nectar. And that is all and everything. On an island that is to Kumbha Kwanta, what our humble coconut palm island is to Kumbha Kwari, under a palm frond canopy, not so different from the lazy cabana beneath which we sleep and eat, make our crafts and keep our rituals, make love and entertain death, only macrocosmically more so. Under just such a canopy, there lives a young girl named Zara. She's a potter. That is, she makes pots. Pots within pots. Pots within pots within pots. Pots all the way down, you might even say. And this is what she does. In the very deepest, and therefore very smallest pot, she lets fall a single drop of her blood. And she corks them up, all the way up, and on the convergence of the three sisters, hurls the pots within pots into the greater ocean. And as the scent of blood brings a flood of subtle life energies to colonize the pots within pots, So a reality is born. A reality. A consciousness. A soul. An eye to be through. Another eye to see through. Cast into the sea of energy to catalyze the fermentation process. And so, for now, they float and bob and drift away into the elsewhere. Wherefore does a young girl craft pots only to toss them into the sea? Whereof, on an island of coconut palms, do they acquire the hardwood necessary to feed a furnace capable of firing so many such clay pots? Wherever, for that matter, is clay to be found on a small tropical island? Such are the questions of the wise, but let us be contented to acknowledge that we congregated here and now are not to be counted among their lofty ranks, nor ever shall we be. So please forgive me if I let such wise questions lie. Here a fool speaks before a congregation of fools. Do you doubt it? And, therefore, let us indulge for a moment in the pursuit of foolishness. Can Zara craft a pot so small it cannot be filled with a single drop of blood without overflowing? Can Zara stack her pot so far down a single drop of blood dropped into their mouths will never strike the bottom? Or so deep that the sound of the drop hitting the bottom will never again reach the top? Can Zara shape a pot with a curvature so pronounced that the eternities contained within its walls bend in upon themselves like serpents devouring their own tails, so that a drop of blood splashing, so that a drop of blood splashes against the bottom before ever it fell? These are the questions I would ask, if one there were to address such inquiries. But for you, my dear listeners, for now, I'm afraid I have no such answers. Can you accept it? Each pot the young girl creates is, so they say, a masterpiece, as perfect as a goddess can wish to be. After so many cycles of perfect pots within pots, however, she eventually came to grow bored of her effortless perfections and decided to make a pot that was somewhat less than perfect. And so she did, and she felt a certain wicked delight over her miscreation. It was bad, and she knew it, and she loved it, and she made another, and another, and another, and she stacked her flawed pots down, all the way down, and placed a single drop of her blood in the very deepest, and therefore very smallest pot. And she corked it up, all the way up, and hurled it as far from herself as she possibly could, for she hates it so. And Zara realized then that she loves it too, and only hates it for how deeply she loves it. She realizes this, and she despairs that she has tossed it so far away and lost it. Just then, her mother returns home to find her daughter crying a sea of celestine tears, flooding the island, flooding the hearth, flooding all of creation. What's wrong, my daughter? Why are you like this, little Zarla? Although in truth, Mother already knew. Mother always knew. I grew bored of making perfect pots, so I made a broken one, and it was more perfect than all the others, and it was my favorite, and I hated it for being broken. So I threw it as far away into the sea as I possibly could, and now I can't find it. I can't find it. I'll never find it again, cried little Zara. Oh, my daughter. Oh, my Zarala. Such is simply the way of it. But if you should really love your broken pot so much, I think I know of a way you can find it among all those perfect pots. Listen. Your blood shines within every pot you have ever shaped. But you cannot see that light because it is trapped within. And so you will never know the perfection of all your perfect pots. But from the broken pot, the light shines through the cracks, and you can see it, and it will call out to you like a fire in the endless night, and you will find it. And it is more perfect than all the others, precisely because of its flaws. You have discovered the secret of your craft. Now go, my child, find your masterpiece. And so she makes a raft and sets out to find her broken pot. And when she finally finds it, and she does, she promises that she will stay with us forever and never leave us again. For she loves us so, us, who are blood of her blood, flesh of her flesh. And so she enters the broken pots within pots, through the cracks, and she loves us for what we are, flawed and perfect, and perfect. Thus spoke Ashtika, prophet of Zara, upon a strange and distant world, in a time that was not his own. So that is just a little bit of, you could say, storytelling, modern myth-making. Just an exercise for my own amusement, really. And I would encourage all of my listeners out there, do the same. Whatever your art form is, whatever your medium, express it. Bring it to life. I know all of you out there have so many beautiful ideas. Let's bring them forward. Let's share them. If we're not here to do that, what are we here for?
Yes, that was very nice. And I started to, very quietly in the background, is a piece that actually Evan helped write, I believe. This thing.
Actually a project me and my good friend Ben Zeiderwig, a amazing electronic music producer, and my old roommate back in Arcata. This is a project where I was sitting in with him. We call these tracks Ariana. Because, you know, that's our little multimedia experiment. And of course, he, you know, produces mostly to his own stuff under the name Sketchy B. And I'm going to be playing, throughout the show in future weeks, showing some of his music, and, you know, we might even have him call in and maybe do an interview with him one day.
Sure.
But, this is our, late night excursion through the frequencies here. And it's nice to have a way to show it and get it out in the world.
And it's our first experiment with uploading audio at Main Street Universe. It was the intro and the outro for today's show. And I also have a song of my own uploaded here I might use for a future show. So we're starting to work on all these things. And soon we're going to be using, also, we're going to start looking for adapters for technology that won't be speaking through the phones as we are. It'll be through a microphone. We can already use Skype, but I'm actually going to try to do something even better than that. See how it works. We have $1,000 microphones here, and we're talking in the phones.
Beautiful.
but hey,
the technology needs to be utilized.
Nothing's perfect. Get on the air first.
Absolutely. So just I want to throw in a couple more words, and then I'll leave you with Dan to fill you in on the rest of the Main Street Universe Network and the other shows that he has and the upcoming news. I just want to end this by saying future shows, and the time might change. It's not certain yet, but I think for the most part it's going to be on Thursdays. Might switch to evenings, possibly, but this morning slot's nice too. 11 a.m. Eastern Time every Thursday. That's 8 a.m. for all you West Coast peeps out there. I know you're listening.
That's where you're from.
I want to send love out there. Miss you guys. And for future shows, please, if there's anything written that you want to share, you know, trust me, I have so much of my own, trepidation and, anxiety about sharing the stuff that I've written and, getting in front of a public forum like this and bringing forward what I've got, because it's never perfect, An artist is never satisfied with what we've written or what we've done. Of course, it could always be better. But I want this, and Dan has spoken on this before with his own show, I want there to be a sense of community here, a sense that people can call in and share what they've written or share where they're at. Whether it's just stories or experiences or poetry, whatever it is, if we just want to talk or there's ideas that we want to talk about, please, folks, give us a call and come on the air with us. We'd love to have you.
Or even before the show, you can make it a thing, your presence being, hey, contact, you're on our Main Street Universe Facebook page, so contact Evan Pass and say, hey, I have, a story I want him to read on the air or something, or a song uploaded or whatever it is, and sort of do like an art sharing thing, I guess, is what you want to be part of your show, is what I'm gathering.
Absolutely. And that would work perfect, too, because we could set aside some time for you. I think that would be excellent.
Yeah, we could contact you about it ahead of time if they're aware of it, of course.
Right. And, you don't have to contact us ahead of time. Feel free to call in during the show. But
right.
it does, that would be nice because we could schedule time for you. But, yes, I want there to be a community and, a renaissance in the art of storytelling. It's by no means starting here. It's been well underway, and it's never really stopped. But this is just our own little space for bringing that back alive.
All right. And with that, we'll have some time, and we'll probably come back. I'm going to experiment by playing one of my songs. Bit here, and never done this before, so here it goes. And it's a very pretty short song, so it'll probably only take like 2.5-3 minutes. And this one, if it works, is called The Lake. And here we go. An incomplete copy, but here it goes. We're working on it.
Ripple of water form, then it just floated away. I touched the sun, but I can't reach it. My vision was taken away. I fear I'll sink. And the song I makes me think of you. Mm-hmm. now he's unaware of his pain. When he returns, he will be happy, his thoughts will be with him again. And sometimes he fears he'll sing, and the song he hears makes him think of you. Just took its place. When I return, I will be happy, I won't have to do this again. And sometimes I fear I'll sing, and the song
version from the studio here at Cafe Fairfax of a song that's going to be on my new demo. We're going to add other parts, bass, drums, some harmony vocals. In fact, I was just talking to my neighbor down the street, Cammy, and she's going to come in and do some female high harmony vocals. And I guess we'll make a few announcements, and that will be, remember that right now, every Thursday at 11 a.m. on the Main Street Universe Network is Zariana, did I say that right?
Yep, Zariana Radio.
Zariana Radio. And every Wednesday, of course, is the flagship show, Main Street Universe. Every Friday is Walking on the Sidewalk, a Horizon Oracle Journey with Kevin Baird. Sunday is a swing day for us when we need a day for a big guest. Brett Hillman will be starting up some new shows, little half-hour segments during the week. So we are here. We'll continue to be here. We'll continue to grow. And we are growing, and our numbers are slowly going up. It doesn't always look like it here live, but our archive listen numbers are steady and up. We're at a funny time at 11 a.m., so sometimes it, you know, in chat room or in the live listeners aren't as high as, say, they were on a Friday night show or something like that.
Especially on a Thursday.
Yeah, on a Thursday or Wednesday, 11 a.m., but as the word gets out, that slowly increases. Too. We get a lot of them in the phone queue. We get a lot of these phone queue listeners that maybe aren't on chat and they're just listening on the phone. And I see there's another one there now, and I welcome everyone and everyone in the chat room, which is malfunctioning mildly today from time to time, but that happens with Blog Talk Radio and their updates. And we can end this. We got two decks here. For the future of the show, Aaron. All right, Aaron. I just called you Aaron. I
grew up one of my good friends, Aaron. We have
a tarot deck. As I open my box and smell the tea tree and cinnamon oil that I put in the box, I got a Horizon Oracle deck. You want to pick like one from each?
Yeah, that sounds great. I think it's nice. I did a card for Kevin and did a little reading on your show the other week.
Oh, yes. And this will be, Aha. The card from Horizon Oracle involving the show is delegating, which you discussed a little bit, I think. You were talking about other people's participation. So having other people come in and be part of the show and having a sense of community. Because when it's reversed on the Horizon Oracle, that does involve others. Unlike in the Tarot where it's reversed, it just means sort of a reverse meaning of the card's symbolism at times.
Right.
With the Horizon Oracle, the reversed is, it just means this is for you, this is involving others. So it's almost like you want others, when I see this, because you see how this guy's sort of building something here? I know you all can't see that.
His gears.
He's got gears and he's working on it. It's like you want somebody else to help you make this. You want some help. You want some...
Participation.
Absolutely. In the process.
You know, we could spend the entire segment of me talking about whatever topic and reading stuff that I've written.
Mm-hmm.
But really, folks, that's not what I want this to be. That's not what I want to do with it. I want to hear what you guys have to say.
You want it to feel active like I do. I'm like that, too. I have that external nature where I like activity, and I grew up in a big family of five children, and my mom ran a daycare center, so there was always somebody around, and I've always liked things to feel active, and there's lots of folks around, and like I said, I kind of usually live in urban environments and like to be around people.
And remember, I want to hear your stories. I could read my stories anytime I want, but bring your stories out, share them with all of our listeners. Share them with me. I would love to hear them.
Another aspect of the 714 card is that it involves being given something to do that someone else might fear doing. So you see he's got this project here, these gears, and he's maybe somebody else. So maybe taking on a radio show is something not everybody would do. Not that it's that scary, but it is a performance, and some people are scared to speak in public. So that's another aspect of the Devil. Now let's draw a tarot card and see if we get sort of a comparative reading. And which I like to sometimes pick just one from each for fun, you know. And
by the way, folks, I know you can't see him, but Dan has an exquisite set of tarot cards. Very nice box, beautiful.
Very cheap box, but yeah, it's a cool looking wooden box. With the leaf inlays on it and all.
If it was cheap, you got a bargain.
This was a few dollars at a thrift store, you know. And
well, thrift stores, you know, it's an excellent place to find stuff like that.
And this, I think, is a fairly accurate card. Again, just a.
That looks like the Knight of Cups.
The Knight of Cups. A general reading about the show. Again, Knight of Cups is an artistic knight. I always view this one as he is moving, but not as fast, say, as maybe the Knight of Wands. But the horse's leg is up, so there's movement. But he is still stopping to appreciate. This is again. I've always viewed this as a very artistic card. And we're sort of talking about artistic endeavors. Of course, cups are emotion and intuition and all
creativity
of those things
to
as
an
well.
Extent, right?
Creativity, again, yeah, very artistic, creative, emotional.
And when I think of the suit of cups, I sort of have an association with each of the four suits. You know, as far as what it is, what aspect of humanity that they represent. For me, cups, like you said, emotions, intuition, creativity. And love as well, you know, heart energy.
Absolutely.
Like the heart, the cup in a human body is the heart. You know, that's where that...
Chalice.
Yeah, the chalice.
Womb and heart, perhaps, even, you know.
Right. But it is a heart energy. And it's funny because there's the idea that the knight is always a warrior. The knight is someone who does battle, you know. But what are you doing battle for? You know, what is the knight fighting for? And that's perhaps one of the reasons I love the Knight of Cups so much, because you know,
it's a great
person. It's a warrior on his steed, fighting for love and creativity.
And what I also like about this, and it's a great card for just a general reading about an artistic endeavor, by the way, is that there is something in his way. You see that little river there? I mean that little stream, but. It definitely looks like, okay, there's an obstacle, and there might even be obstacles beyond it, that little mountain and all that. But the horse is lifting its leg, and these are nothing that can't be overcome. And that's what I get when I look at that card.
Takes everything in course.
Yeah. In stride. You know, it's very definitely, in this case, literally, a plane is flying overhead. In a mini stride, as the horse is patiently, because I view this as unlike, say, the Knight of Wands or Swords, where they charge forward. This is a patient... but still active. You know, you are moving forward. You're about to step over this little river. And it's still active, though. So there's action going on here. And I think I'll do that. And then clean the deck. Shuffling it. Yeah, I think I avoided saying heart. Sometimes when you read, you try to sometimes avoid the obvious because you feel like you're being redundant and you really even shouldn't. You know what I mean? So I went with the
art direction. Of course, it was sort of an artistic general statement we were looking for,
but definitely cups is the suit of matters of the heart
as well. But the matters of the heart don't
always mean romance. Don't always mean money. It can be physical pleasure, something that's satisfying. And look at this one was left out, so I figured, oh my gosh, look at the one that was left out accidentally.
The Nine of Cups. And like I said,
you couldn't ask for a much better card to be left out accidentally.
No, the Nine of Cups. You know, I always think, you know, like I said, I think of the cards in terms of the Thoth Tarot. This is not the Thoth Tarot. This is a different. I actually haven't seen this one before, but these cards are beautiful. But I know in the Thoth Tarot, the Nine of Cups is happiness, right?
It's even Nine of Cups is sometimes referred to as a wish card, a wish come true card. And so here's what I got. Since we're doing a finished accidental reading, I saw this one popped out too, since I'm clumsy. As long as we get over bad behaviors and obsessions. I got the devil reversed.
Reversed.
So overcoming obstacles with good delegation and good relationships, if you combine the Horizon Oracle with the Knight of Cups, and then the Knight of Cups popped out accidentally.
I actually left it out accidentally.
Well, shuffling. And which is, of course, a very positive, fulfilling card. And then finishing off with the Devil Reverse. That one might be speaking to me, making sure I don't go crazy with my obsessions, bad behavior, addictions, partying too much, all of that sort of stuff, all that sort of things that can get in the way.
We all know Dan is a rager.
Continue to work out, be physical, stay focused on my better health than I have sometimes in the past.
Beautiful.
For things to work out. So I think that one was a little bit
cool. I love it, Dan. Thank you for the reading.
Sure. And we ended up coming down to about 15 minutes. Time has gone by quicker than I thought for this experiment. We had some fun things to mess with. I've never messed with the audio uploads before.
Mm-hmm.
And I have personally done on-air reading for a while. That was fun. And I really think they're really good cards, very accurate. Or hopefully something along the lines that I was thinking myself. So it seemed to be in tune anyway as far as the Knight of Cups is a great card. I thought the Horizon Oracle card was good. And, of course, the wish come true as long as you stay focused and be healthy and don't let your obsessions and your bad behavior overcome. I think that one was more for me than for Evan. But which I've been better. And I've been working out and getting physical. And it's an interesting road. They say it takes, like, you know, something like 30 days to develop a good habit, you know, getting to the gym. And of course, I ride my bike to work every day and work with a dog at that place. Evan actually works with me.
Absolutely. And, you know, I this is something I've been noticing myself is, you know, I've been cutting out certain habits as well, you know, cultivating the mind, you know, making it a nice place to inhabit, the body a nice place to inhabit, and eating better.
Yes,
I'd like to really emphasize that because it's almost like hitting me like a revelation just the past couple of weeks, how much I'm affected by the foods I eat, and like how strongly that affects my mind and my entire outlook. This very simple, just the food you eat. There's nothing else to it. And it's like the last week, I've really been a lot better about that, and eating very good fruits and. You know, I've been eating a lot of pomegranates lately. Yeah, I've fallen in love with pomegranate. It's something
really
I used
good.
To eat in the past, but it's such a beautiful fruit, and that's a fruit where there's so much mythology behind it, you know.
I love pomegranate juice. It's kind of like, it's like the other cranberry juice in a way. Pomegranate
is better, I think
it's better, too.
Yeah.
The pomegranate kefir, I like. And when I eat more, I'm not necessarily vegetarian, but when I eat a lot more raw fruits and vegetables, my energy levels are so much higher. Yesterday, I felt like I was coming down with a cold, and then I seemed to have blown it away quickly. I made some fresh ginger tea Of course, I'm not your doctor, folks, so I got those disclaimers out there, but when I make it, like, really strong, I let it steep for a long time, and it really seems to advance taking any kind of cold away, as well as I took some, I take some liquid turmeric extract. And
excellent. That's good Ayurvedic medicine right there.
Yeah, turmeric is interesting, and it's good for the throat. They say it's really, and they've done scientific studies on that, folks. It's not just me or just a natural doctor saying it. Don't necessarily want to just put the word "just" in front of natural doctor, but that's all, you know, mainstream views at times. But scientists have been doing research on turmeric and its effects, especially on things like throat. I think it was esophageal cancer. They were testing patients having like really good results using a turmeric extract, which turmeric is the stuff that makes mustard yellow, curry. It's in all of those things and has been known in India to fight cancer and things for forever.
It clears the skin, you know, the turmeric is very sacred in India.
Yeah.
Because, like, so many health benefits to it, and people use it for everything. Dan is not your doctor, neither am I, but I think we both encourage you, all our listeners out there, to eat lots of turmeric.
Yeah, and I love curry.
You know, have a good curry, you know. Everyone enjoys that.
The fish curry at Curry Mantra. You and I ate lunch the other day at Curry Mantra. I don't mind giving them a free plug. It's very close to my house, and it's an Indian restaurant around here that I really like, and not ridiculously priced. It still looks, you know, I think you'll get like what the lunch buffet is like a $9 or $10 meal, something.
Yeah.
Like that. But it's all you can eat, and it's really with some for being a buffet. There's a lot more passion in it than you might think when you hear the word buffet.
Yeah,
they really do.
It's
look
true.
I was good
impressed.
Job.
And you know, coming from. The Arcata Eureka area, where you're hard pressed to find any good Indian food, although it should be everywhere because everyone out there likes Indian food.
Yeah.
There's only one Indian food place there. It's not that good, and it's terribly expensive.
And this reminds me. Oh,
for years, I've just, you know, ever since I got back from India, me and my roommates have had to cook our own Indian food, and you know that went well. But you know, it's nice to have a place down the street or a couple of places where you can just get some good food.
And I also, as your new host, I did want to give you a gift. Since you're here live in person.
Oh, wow.
And there it is.
Oh, Dan, thank you. This is a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. The song Celestial.
It's a little one. I like how it also has the marker that's like almost the biblical book. I like when books have that little, you know, material attached book marker in it. Almost biblical style. It's sort of a mini Bhagavad Gita. Like, it's bigger than a pocket version. It's like, what, about 6-7 inches across and wide. So I thought you might like that because I know that's sort of, I figured you might already have a copy. Or maybe not because you've moved and you know you lose things in a move.
Let's see. I probably have 5 or 6 copies of this.
Oh, really?
But Dan,
but
I can't tell you. It means so much. And, you know, I treasure every copy of this I have, and this is a book I live my life by, and I appreciate it so much.
You're a collector of Bhagavad Gita.
Here, let's see. Open up a random page and read a little bit.
A little bibliomancy.
Tranquil in spirit, free of fear, intent upon his brahmacharya vow, devout, musing on me, lost in the thought of me. That yogin, so devout, so controlled, comes to the peace beyond, my peace. The peace of high nirvana.
Now, let me see. Here, we'll both. I'll pick one now. Let Dave decide here.
The great teachings of Krishna to Arjuna, the charioteer.
And I am he that fathers, sending seed, Satwan, Rahas, and Tamas. So are named the qualities of nature. Soothfastness, passion, and ignorance. These three bind down the changeless spirit in the changeful flesh. Sounds to me like talking about obsessions there.
Yeah, those sattva, rajas, and tamas are the three gunas. And what they say in the Hindu metaphysical system, everything in the universe and everything we experience is some combination of these three gunas. They're the three essential qualities that mix and are part of everything. Sattva is defined you know, of course, we can't have perfect definitions of Sanskrit words, but we try.
Right, right.
Is defined as meditative equipoise. Just you can imagine this, like that quality of that quality that we understand as the essence of yoga, of good living, of you know, being luminous and tranquility, and there's a certain like lightness of being. You know, light in the sense that you of shedding light, but also lightness in the sense of, you know, physically weight, being freed of gravity. And, you know, again, so much of that is good eating. That's sattva. Rajas is same root as for raja, which means king. And what you get there, it's like, that's passion. That's, you know, it's like lust, it's hunger, it's drive, it's energy. Think of, you know, because I know so many of our listeners are going to understand the astrological reference. Think of Aries.
Mm-hmm.
Aries is pure rajas. That's
just
like the initiating
forward
energy, like, you know, springtime, fiery. It represents fire. Sattva is actually associated with the water element. And in tamas, you know, we could see we're going in a certain direction here.
Right.
Tamas is like sleep. Tamas is, you know, kind of indolence, laziness, slothfulness. And things like anger can really fall into either one of those, you know, because anger has a certain quality of rajas and a certain quality in tamas. But tamas is really just like the idea of being unconscious, going through life, you know, not being aware of anything, just
So in the passage I read, it mentioned binding you. Was that saying something about, I was just saying off the top of my head, it sounded like it was, I just literally just opened it up and read something for a paragraph. It sounded to me like it was relating something about obsession.
Right. Now, here's the thing about the three gunas and how what it means to cultivate yoga. Now, everything in this existence, as I said, is a combination of these three. But the goal, you could say, is to transcend the gunas and not to let them affect you.
Now,
even though sattva, of course, is, you know, we could call the best or the most ideal and what we're all striving for, even that is something to be transcended. Because there is a state of being that is beyond the gunas altogether. What we are, the essential nature, that within us, which is Krishna, which is God, you know, the indwelling spirit, ultimately is not bound by the gunas. But it is, as long as we exist in these bodies, in the world, all we can experience are the gunas, in whatever combination. But the spirit itself is beyond that. And the goal of cultivating yoga is transcending the gunas altogether and dwelling permanently and completely in the spirit. You know, for such incredibly tamasic people as myself, you know, we're just working on, you know, raising that up into sattva-like quality all the time and, you know, doing what we can. But, you know, you can imagine for the great saints and yogis out there, sattva is not the stopping point. You know, sattva, again, is still of this phenomenal world. And that's what Krishna is showing us in the Bhagavad Gita, is as long as we're caught in the three gunas, we're caught in the web of karma. Everything that we do is, you know, so to speak, getting us entangled further in the karmic web. You know, every action leading to new actions. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's, in fact, it's a necessity. It's you know, karma is not a bad thing, of course. Like, there's a rhyme and a reason to everything in creation. We would not exist as embodied beings without karma. It's an absolute necessity. But now that we've realized that, and we've realized we're tripping karmic wires with every thought, with every breath, and with every step, Krishna tells us is you can move through the web without tripping any of these wires by giving up all your thoughts to me. What you essentially are, beyond all your gunas, beyond all the baggage, everything that you identify yourself with and think you are, within all that, and you can never really find it, there is no pointing your finger to it, that is Krishna. And acting from that, from that source, that indwelling divinity, that spark within every human being, within every life form, we traverse the web of karma without ever tripping the web, without ever getting tangled, and it's just effortless.
As you know, I'm pagan, and on a pagan website, there was some debates, not that heated, but in a forum I was in recently about karma. Of course, a lot of them were saying, "Oh, I don't believe in karma," and I'm like, "Well, I don't think it's really a matter of, you know, do you believe in gravity? You know what I mean? You know, it's just now what the pagan view on karma. By that I mean sort of the / Wiccan pagan view. Of course, it was considered a, you know, polytheistic. Some might even use the word pagan religion, without trying to offend anybody if they don't like that term. I apologize, but I'm saying technically." The witchy pagan view might be different than, you know, how a Hindu would say karma is. We don't really have time for that discussion now. That could be for another day. But the idea of karma is just, I view it almost as just energy itself. Like you said, those little strings and things that trip, and it's like it's like some people say you're always negotiating a contract with your higher self, and it's like these little karma buttons that you push all over the place are part of what's making up that contract.
Right. Karma is so simple, and, you know, I do find it somewhat amusing, too, that, you know, you would say that you don't believe in karma. Well, that may be the case for a certain interpretation of karma, but that's not, you know, there's New Age interpretations of karma, and it's sort of been taken to mean something that it is not in its original context. Karma in Sanskrit, very simply, means action. That's the best definition we have for it. Karma is action. And if you believe in action, then karma is inevitable. That's what it is. There's the idea that every action limits your future actions, right? If we do one thing, we've created a certain set of circumstances for ourselves for further action. If we do another thing, we have a different set of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Everything we do, in a certain sense, limits us, and in another sense, can liberate us. But karma is a fascinating topic. We could talk about it endlessly. We will have to save that for
another day.
Another day.
And thank you very much, Evan. Great for you to be here and to do your first episode.
And thank you very much, Dan. It's went excellent, and I love the cards that we drew. Do you have anything else to say for your Main Street Universe listeners?
Yep, we're just going to say, remember, we're here every Thursday at 11, every Wednesday at 11 a.m. as well, and Friday from 5 to 7, and Sundays are swing days that we use for special occasions, special guests that can't make it on the other days. Remember that the mysteries and possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine a lot.